This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is trying to pull every Republican voter and fat cat contributor into her big tent Democratic Party. But what does that mean for Black and working people? And Black activists remember the legacy of Robert Williams, the former NAACP leader in Monroe, North Carolina, who championed Black people's right to armed self-defense.
But first, the Green Party has assembled a full ticket to challenge the two-party duopoly system. Presidential candidate Jill Stein tapped veteran Black activist Ajamu Baraka as her vice presidential candidate. Baraka is the founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Baraka accepted the vice presidential slot not long before the Green Party held its national convention in Houston earlier this month. We asked him how that happened. That was Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party's vice presidential candidate.
Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, the Democratic and Republican standard bearers, last week submitted their economic programs to the American people. We spoke with Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar and activist with the Black Radical Organizing Committee in Philadelphia. Dr. Montero says Clinton and Trump have reversed the historical party positions of left and right when it comes to the economy. Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia.
In Detroit this month, Black scholars and activists came together to celebrate the life of Robert F. Williams, the former NAACP leader in Monroe, North Carolina, who in the 1950s formed a Black armed guard to defend Black people from racist violence. Robert Williams and his wife, Mabel, were forced into exile in Cuba in 1961, where he wrote the book Negroes with Guns and published a newspaper called The Crusader. One of those who honored Williams was Dr. Akinyele Umoja, the chair of the African American Studies Department at Georgia State University and author of the book, We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. He says Robert Williams' legacy is relevant today.
It was something that was pretty sudden. You know, Glenn, I've always thought about not running for office, but part of sort of my theoretical grappling with progressive politics in the U.S. has been around this issue of how we relate to the electoral process. I've always felt that this notion that there was some kind of objective principle around non-participation in bourgeois politics had no real grounding, that was a strategic decision, that this should be based on the objective conditions, any social movement, party, or whatever, and that those spaces in the bourgeois process that any group, any social movement thought it might be able to exploit if it felt like that was part of its broader plan to build power, then they should in fact do that. But for many years, we didn't really have serious conversations on the left about those kinds of possibilities. But I think that for me, I saw that the conditions were such where basically we had to really begin to revisit that. So I've been given quite some time in terms of thinking. And so when Jill called me, basically out of the blue, and shared that she wanted to consider me joining her on this ticket, I had to think about that. And I thought about it. And when we talked a couple of days later, after, you know, talking with a few people, I said, hey, let's do it. And I said, let's do it, Glenn, because Jill assured me that this campaign was, in fact, about building or attempting to build an alternative to the Democratic plantation for folks who might want to pursue electoral politics, that she saw this as a process in which we could, in fact, make a difference this year by transcending the politics of fear, that people were looking for an alternative, and that Bernie Sanders' campaign was one of the expressions of that desire. So I said, you know what, this is something we should look at. And I saw this as something that would allow myself to be able to engage in a conversation and to step out there and have that conversation with black forces also. You know, we didn't get a chance to finish the experiment that we were doing in Jackson, Mississippi, you know, before Brother Lumumba passed away. So this was something I thought that we could experiment with, if you will.
Leftists of all stripes around the world, very few have rejected bourgeois politics entirely. It's been a question of the time and conditions. So why today, 2016, and the Green Party?
Well, there is a political alignment, realignment taking place in this country. And with this realignment taking place, I think that we have an opportunity to advance the conversation around how we strategically might use the electoral process. I think with the Clinton machine consolidating itself on the right, and we see the white working class elements grouping themselves around Trump and Trumpism, there's a lot of space in between for progressive forces, and there needs to be some kind of ability for groups that want to break away from the Democratic Party to have that opportunity. So I think 2016 is the beginning of that process. Now, how long we are going to be able to exploit that remains to be seen, because the limited democratic process we have now is under pressure. And with the continued deterioration of the democratic processes and this economy and the clear tendency on the part of the state to repress political opposition, our time is limited in terms of how far we can and to what extent we can take advantage of the limited democratic space that does exist. So we need to move on that now.
You spoke of Trumpism. Lots of Democrats call that fascism, and they're trying to herd as many people as possible into the Democratic ranks in fear of fascism. But who is the fascist here?
That's a good question. They have been effective in utilizing the politics of fear to the extent that across the board on the progressive and so-called left side, the main fear is Trump and Trumpism. Now, what that has done is to completely let off the hook the continued, steady, rightward trajectory of the Democratic Party, a party that has not shied away from being repressive, an Obama administration that has not been reluctant to use the Espionage Act to prosecute whistleblowers, to put Chelsea Manning in prison for 35 years, to repress Occupy Wall Street, to unleash their various intelligence forces across the country to infiltrate and, we believe, to disrupt legal oppositional work among groups that are involved in anti-police violence work. So we don't have to even talk about what's happening internationally. So this consolidation on the part of the right, on the part of the right wing of the Democratic Party, it's happening with almost no opposition because everybody's looking the other direction at Trumpism. So we've got to be able to call attention to what's really happening and to wake people up to the fact that with the abandonment of many elements of the right wing from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, that basically it's clear from Clinton's nomination of Tim Kaine and their strategy that they are using to build their campaign going forward, the complete humiliation of Bernie Sanders and his supporters, is clear that they are engaged in a process of triangulation, if you will, in which they are now going to end up reducing labor and the social movements that are still relating to the Democratic Party further to in the margins of the center of Democratic politics. So what we have is a troubling development here, and we've got to be able to be in a position to have honest conversations with the American people so people can understand what's really in play.
The Green Party's registering 5 or 6% in the polls, but possibly the more interesting number is that about 80% of the folks never heard of Jill Stein or the Green Party.
That is interesting, and that's why some of the Clinton forces are attempting to try to define the Green Party before people really get a chance to understand what the Green Party and the Stein-Baraka campaign is all about. And we've seen some of those efforts over the last week or so. The other interesting thing about what's happening with this campaign and politics in the U.S. is that, you know, when you start looking at the demographics in terms of what sectors are more open to independent politics, we find that there are very large numbers of young people who are willing and ready to strike out in an independent direction and who are open to really radical and progressive positions. We know that there have been polls that have indicated that large percentages of young people are open to the notion of socialism and are grappling with what that really means. And in places like California, the campaign has up to 16-17% support among young people. So there's real potential here for perhaps developing a viable third-party option. But we have to deal with the fact that because of that, they're trying to crush this movement in its early stages.
And of course, third parties include black parties. Is this particular era fertile ground for a reemergence of black politics, which could take place in the same milieu that we see a resurgence of Greens?
It can and it should, and I don't see the two as mutually exclusive. I think that we have to have a new black politics. There's no question about that. How that black politics will express itself institutionally remains to be seen. If it wants to engage in some degree of electoral politics, then you either have to build a structure or you can operate through this existing structure. One of the things we're going to talk about, especially in places like the South, is how people might want to relate to this Green Party structure. A structure that is relatively wide open. So the Green Party and black electoral politics, I mean, the Green Party has to be seen as a vehicle, a structure, an instrument, if you will. And so people can take a look at this and decide whether or not it's something that they can work through, or if they believe that it should build something separate and independent, so be it. These are the kinds of strategic conversations we want to have across the country.
The Jim Crow South used to be a one-party state, Democrat and whites only. Now for black folks, effectively, there is in the community a kind of one-party state, and it is Democrat. How did the Greens break through that one-party scenario?
You're absolutely right, and that's why I'm advocating that we need to perhaps look at developing our own sort of Southern strategy, if you will. You know, Glenn, when you look at the fact that, for example, in this upcoming national election, across the South, the votes of black people and the votes of Democrats, for that matter, are basically, they don't really count because we're talking about red states, basically. So you don't really have a chance to participate in the election of the next president. So my position is basically, why not begin to organize an alternative? Why should we remain on the Democratic plantation when it doesn't really count when it comes to national elections? And when it comes to local and state elections, we still have an opportunity now to build something independent from the Democratic Party. So we can have our own sort of Southern strategy, if you will, to see if folks want to consider how they might want to relate to this Green Party structure across the South and to give people an option when it comes to national elections and even state and local elections. Last week, I met a number of people at the Green Party convention, black folks, Latinos, who are running for various offices in various parts of the country. These are progressive people who are part of local organizations who have decided that as part of their movement building strategy, they're going to attempt to try to take some of those local bases to advance their agenda and to secure resources. So those kinds of efforts are on the way. I think they're going to continue. And so I think it'd be to our advantage to at least have these conversations with folks. I'm not out here suggesting that we're going to get liberation through voting. That's not going to happen. But I think that it's important for us to consider having some structures in which social movements can relate to, if they so choose to do so, in terms of confronting and working through the existing state and bourgeois politics.
There's a lot more Sanders supporters than there are Green Party members, and I would suspect there are a lot more Sanders supporters who are thinking green than there are Green Party members. Is the Green Party prepared infrastructurally to accommodate these folks who don't want to go along with the Democrats this time around?
I think that the party appears to be trying to get there. There are, of course, challenges, but before the party can incorporate all of these various elements, it has to try to make sure that the momentum that was coming out of that Sanders campaign does not get dissipated. One of the things that the Clinton folks are in fact trying to do is to try to undermine that momentum. They want to advance the argument that supporting the Green Party is basically to support Donald Trump. And many people are falling for that. Now, there are significant numbers of people who are still coming over. So now what they're trying to do is undermine the ticket itself. So these folks are playing to win because they know that if the race tightens up again in those key swing states, that support for the Green Party can tip the election. So they're trying to preempt that, if you will. So there's tremendous opportunity for the Greens. Whether or not those opportunities can be realized, it's something that remains to be seen. We think that this is an opportunity for more people to come toward independent politics, and that's what we are running on. We are talking about bringing power to the people and developing a real democracy here in this country, a democracy that would allow us to advance a people's agenda.
Because of WikiLeaks, we know that the Democrats played dirty tricks on Bernie Sanders. You've only been the vice presidential candidate for a couple of weeks, but have they played any dirty tricks on you or that you know about?
Well, it hasn't even been a couple of weeks yet, and they definitely are playing their tricks. All of a sudden, for example, after all these years of activism, I get a Wikipedia page, and in that is all kinds of inaccurate information. We know that there have been a number of articles. They've gone back and pulled out all the stuff that I've written. The first objective was try to separate me from the Sanders folks by suggesting that I wasn't welcoming to the Sanders movement. And now they shift the gears to trying to suggest that, you know, the old canard of a black person being, you know, anti-Semitic. And so they are playing serious hardball. And so we have to just grapple with that. But yeah, they are playing dirty tricks. And the way they do that is to use the media and to have their attack articles and to widely disseminate those articles. And we expected that when we got into the campaign, and we expect that will continue. They have been doing the same thing with Jill Stein. And now we saw just a few days ago that the new angle is to paint her as another Putin apologist. So constructing us as sort of the loony left is part of the narrative to try to undermine the campaign.
Loony takes on new meanings this campaign season. I've never seen the Democrats actually McCarthyiting the Republicans, the world in reverse.
Exactly. I mean, everything is up in the air now. Everything that we thought meant something now is contested. I mean, the whole notions of left, right, middle, and all of that, they're in flux. You look at what happened at the Democratic Party convention, and basically it took on the symbolism, the tone, the look of a Republican convention. What is liberal today? People refer to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton as liberals, where we say that they basically, at best, are center-right, if not neocons. And then you look at what's happening with the right that's splitting, and you got the libertarians that have their positions, that you have people on the right who are questioning U.S. imperialism, and you got the Donald Trump who is questioning the value of NATO and suggesting that these international trade agreements are detrimental to workers in the U.S., while you have Democrats who are basically supporting it. So everything is in flux. What we see is a continuation, really an intensification of the governmental crisis that emerged in 2008. And it's being played out in the body politics of this country right now. So everything is in flux, and that's why 2016 is such a transformative moment for politics here in this country.
Bourgeois media political pundits tend to lump the libertarians and the greens in the same little marginalized ghetto. But I think it needs to be pointed out that the libertarians' ticket is comprised of two former Republican governors, and the libertarians are marketing themselves as something much closer to the old Republican Party. Wouldn't that make the greens uniquely positioned as the only real left out there?
That's exactly right, and that's really the argument that I've been trying to advance, that with this realignment of politics in the U.S. in terms of parties that are involved in the electoral process, the only authentic structure out there right now is the Green Party. So that is the only institutional home, if you will, for folks who believe that the electoral process has some degree of value. So yes, this is what we have right now, and that's why there is an interesting sort of potential of this process breaking down into a four-way race, especially if it was possible for the libertarians and or the Greens to get to 15% and to get into those debates. If you have a breakdown like that, then you basically have a situation where a plurality of votes can win this election.
First of all, they're political documents. Which means they are appealing to those parts of the electorate that each side feels that it needs, especially in the swing states going forward. Now, having said that, each side basically acknowledge that the American economy is failing the majority of people. The so-called 99 or 90%, and that the economy has benefited especially and pretty much on steroids, the 1% in the period after the 2008-2009 Great Recession, and that the recovery has been a recovery only for a few, and that economic inequality has widened. So each side is looking to the swing states, and each, as you're aware, gave their speeches on the economy in Michigan, which is symbolic of deindustrialization and inequality. Having said that, I think there were also certain contrasts that are very, very important. How the two candidates, that is Trump and Clinton, identified the source of the problem. Clinton said the problem that we face can be remedied by kind of reforming the economy along the edges, that pretty much the policies of financialization, of Wall Street privilege, of trade deals like NAFTA and TPP, and what she calls engagement with the world, are not fundamentally wrong, but that we have to tweak them and not change them. On the other side, and this is what is so striking, Trump, in essence, argues that the problem of the American economy is grounded in the export of capital, which is the sine qua non of the period of capitalism we call finance capitalism, the export of capital, and that the export of capital is the source of the impoverishment of the American working class. Hence, his argument is not for complete restructuring, but for a repatriation of capital. Now, he wants to do that, as he says, through giving incentives to capital that is fleeing the country to come back in the country. And these incentives are tax incentives. Now, clearly, Trump's stating of the problem is far more accurate than Clinton. However, neither Trump nor Clinton provide a solution to the problem of the growing inequality, the growing impoverishment of American workers, and so on. That's the way I saw both speeches.
Hillary Clinton says that she's now opposed to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and she's not fully endorsed its counterpart in the Atlantic. But she's supported all of these so-called free trade, these corporate deals throughout her political career, beginning with NAFTA. And she has not admitted that they have resulted in the wholesale shutdown of U.S. manufacturing.
Absolutely. And as Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia and the close friend and political ally of the Clintons, said a couple of weeks ago to Wall Street, don't worry that when she's elected, she will, in fact, support a form of the TPP and other trade deals. I think it points to the fact that Hillary Clinton is the candidate of finance capital and more particularly Goldman Sachs. So it means nothing that she says she's not for it now. But I think when we look at the essence of her economic language, she is fundamentally saying that there's nothing wrong with the architecture of neoliberal globalized capitalism. Trump is saying the opposite, that there is something fundamentally wrong. Now, neither provides a solution to what is wrong, although Trump is more accurate in where the problem exists. The solution is neither in what Trump is proposing and certainly in what Hillary is proposing. The solution is in a form of state capitalism or what is broadly called a social democratic reorganization of the economy. Capital is not going to be repatriated because you give them tax benefits to bring their money back in the country. And even if they bring it back in the country, there is no guarantee they will invest it in the infrastructure. However, Trump is accurate in this regard. And here he makes pretty much a Keynesian type of argument that if you put money in the pockets of workers, they will buy things and this stagnating economy will begin to grow again. And then from the standpoint of reindustrialization of the United States economy and again putting money in the pockets of American workers, you have a better chance of negotiating fair trade agreements with the rest of the world. I would argue that Trump's position, although not complete, as I've stated, attacks the privileges of finance capital. Hillary's position is to maintain and continue the privileges of finance capital.
Yes, and an historical role reversal, as you explained. We have a Trump that is more Keynesian in his approach to the economy, that is, putting dollars directly in the hands of workers through wages or through not taking away further their wages, than the Democrat who proposes what we used to call Band-Aid fixes, that is, small programs that address certain wounds, but don't really deal with the purchasing power of working people.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is an irony, and this election process has been ironical. And we're seeing all of these reversals that a billionaire, or at least a reputed billionaire, is calling for policies that attack finance capital, the alleged class to which he belongs. But maybe he belongs to a part of that class that is a second-class citizen to the real power, and that is bank capital, finance capital. Trump probably represents more industrial capital, manufacturing capital, building capital, national capital, as opposed to finance capital, which is the essence of imperialism. And on the other side, Clinton does represent that in the most quintessential sense. And as you said, her band-aids on the wounds of the working class are nothing more than that. Now, again, I want to just emphasize that Trump, while identifying the problem, does not have the solution to the problem. He has a partial solution. He understands that capital has to be repatriated. He understands that to get the economy out of the stagnation and near recession, you have to invest in the infrastructure. You have to create good jobs. You have to put money in the pockets and hands of working people. In that sense, he is a Keynesian, but I think he has to go further. And that is not just tax policies, but you have to go to some form of social democratic reorganization of the economy, which means re-regulating the banks, breaking up the biggest of them, and controlling capital. Now, once you go there, you face the possibility of what they call a strike of finance capital against the nation. They withdraw their money and force the country into a recession or a depression, and thus create political conditions to even overthrow the mild Keynesian or social democratic measures that could be put into place. At that point, the class conflict reaches another level. And again, what we're looking at in both proposals, political proposals about the economy, is a intensifying class anger and class resentment at the elite, the 1% or 1/10 of 1% in particular. In a lot of ways, Trump has given voice to it and has stimulated it, has given it language. On the other side, Clinton is seeking to adapt to a different political environment than any politician, presidential candidate, has faced since the time of the New Deal and the Great Depression.
In terms of capital going on strike, capital certainly has long been on strike against industrial development in the United States, sending its dollars instead to take advantage of the lowest wages it can possibly find in the world. And in terms of austerity, that has become a bipartisan policy, certainly one that President Obama tried to make a grand bargain with the Republicans with, and Hillary Clinton says she's with him.
No, I agree with you. And as I said, capital going on strike, I was thinking precisely what you said. They have been on strike against the people of this nation and against this nation for a couple of decades now, but they could really even make it worse. But indeed, the austerity measures and the whole architecture of finance capitalist hegemony has been a declaration of war against working people and the poor, and in particular, black working people and the black poor. And so I would agree with you, and that is why, even in the midst of what I consider to be political chaos and uncertainty and an election that is being fueled by class resentment and anger against the 1%. And even though it is more vocal on the Trump side, it was obvious in the Bernie movement, and it's clearly expressed in the Green Party and Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka, both of whom are trying to become a part of and channel that anger. And that anger is not just on economic questions. It is anger about permanent war and creating chaos and the possibility of war with Russia, where the Clinton forces want regime change, or war with China in the South China Sea. And so all of this is part of the moment that we live in, I think that we could possibly be looking at ethical changes in the nature of American politics and resistance to the 1% or 1/10 of 1%.
You, of course, have identified the Democrats' support for the free flow of capital around the world as the main factor that separates them from Donald Trump. There is, of course, a connection between a U.S. policy of the free flow of capital around the world and the U.S. military empire, because capital flowing freely around the world isn't a benign phenomenon. It's backed Absolutely. Up by the power of the U.S. military to enforce mm-hmm. capital's ability to flow where it wants to go.
And that's why they want regime change in Russia, because capital has to find newer territories to exploit. And under Putin, Russia has entered upon a economic policy of reindustrialization. The West and the United States in particular seeks to slow that down. So you're absolutely right to bring Russia back into the kind of neoliberal dollar dominated world economic order means the overthrow of Putin, regime change as it were, and hence the brinksmanship of the West in placing NATO, mainly U.S. troops, on the borders of Russia, the overthrow of the democratically elected government in the Ukraine, and of course, all of the anti-Putin, anti-Russian rhetoric that we are now seeing is a part of this preparation for war. And of course, in this election cycle, the targeting of Trump as an agent of Putin kind of says two things. One, that the ruling class sees Trump's position, as inconsistent as they might be, as a threat to their large ambitions against Russia. On the other side, it is a recognition that to achieve their ends, they must bring Russia to heel, and they must get Putin out of the way or get him in a position where he has to make strategic compromises with the West.
And so we see yet another historical role reversal, with Democrats acting as the McCarthyites of a previous era, sliming and slandering folks as pro-Russian for political right. gain.
That's right. And Putin and Trump are similar in that both are calling for détente, a demilitarization of relationships in Eastern Europe. Trump has gone further and called for demilitarization and denuclearization, military and foreign policy in Northeast Asia. I mean, this is quite significant. I mean, it's coming from a person whose constituency has generally been associated with conservatism and war, pro-war policies. Now, obviously, his constituency is not of one mind. It is divided. And he reflects that in his ambiguous and inconsistent statements on matters of foreign policy. However, there is a critical part of his constituency which is saying that war and these trade policies like TPP are damaging the American economy and the American working class. And somehow, and for reasons that for many of us is difficult to explain or to locate, they're seeing these wars as a problem in terms of investing in the domestic economy. This is very important, I think.
As even the New York Times has pointed out, neither one of these presidential candidates has mentioned the word poverty, as if it does not exist.
Yeah, that's very interesting because, again, and I'm not going to vote for Trump, and I'm not a, quote, Trump supporter in this regard, but you have to give the devil his due. Trump has questioned the official unemployment numbers. And he has said, for example, that if you take the African-American community and African-American youth, he said between 58% and 60% are either unemployed or outside of the labor force altogether. And this is the source of impoverishment. He has come closest. And I've said, I don't know whether I've said it to you, but he has said more in a couple of speeches about the dire and severe conditions of black people than Barack Obama said in 7 or 8 years. So he has begun to acknowledge that the economic plight of working people and even of African-American working people is far worse than the government and the politicians in the Democratic Party or the Republican elite have been prepared to acknowledge. But in terms of an anti-poverty program that addresses the poor, the 42 million who live in poverty, or maybe a little bit more, neither has done that. At least Trump, an industrial policy, a jobs policy, a type of Keynesianism will address the problem of poverty. Clinton has pretty much said that some forms of tax relief and $12 an hour minimum wage will be her form of an anti-poverty program.
In terms of growth in the U.S. economy, there's been very, very little. And if one takes into account the inflation that somehow gets negated by the government reports, there may be no growth at all in the U.S. economy. But Hillary Clinton seems to be saying that more of the same will achieve better results. And Donald Trump seems to be saying that a cessation of these bad deals will somehow work a miracle.
Well, cessation of bad deals, trade deals, and the repatriation of capital and inducing big capital to invest in the reindustrialization of the United States. Clearly, the targeting of trade deals and the export of capital out of the country explains the almost flat economic growth, the near recession growth, or as some have called it, stagnation growth. This export of capital does explain that. And of course, the pro-Wall Street economists like the Paul Krugmans of the world are calling this the new normal. And so high levels of unemployment and underemployment and people dropping out of the labor force and high levels of poverty are acceptable to finance capital. However, it becomes a difficult problem when working people and the poor are somehow awakened to what the game is, to a crooked and rigged economy, which is rigged against them. And so, like Brexit in England, without a program of going forward, the working class in England decided that they would teach the elites a political lesson. And that is motivating a lot of what we see. That same sentiment is motivating a lot of what we see going on in the American election.
It is not clear that measures that would put a price on creating jobs overseas would automatically result in private companies creating more jobs over here. However, there's nothing in history that teaches us that. A project for more jobs would call for a public policy of job creation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's why I say, while Trump is more accurate in identifying the source of the problem, he does not have a solution. And that is why I would say a social democratic reorganization of the economy. Now, I think we're both right in suggesting that Trump moves closer to something that looks like a Keynesian prescription for the ills that affect the economy, far closer than Clinton does. But then he kind of undercuts it with the idea that, well, if we make it less hurtful in terms of taxes for big corporations to bring their money back in the country, that will make it possible for them to do it. As you point out, there are no historical precedents for that that I know of, and that the only answer is to seize a good part of the capital that the large banks have and to then redirect that to the reindustrialization of the country. The other thing that we haven't mentioned is the capacity for taking over the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and printing money to stimulate the economy rather than to buy bad bonds and stocks from the banks and the multinational corporations, what they call QE 1, 2, 3, and 4. So drastic measures are going to be called for to solve this economic malaise that we're in. And in this election cycle, I don't see either of the candidates putting forward the type of measures that will resolve this problem. I think that is a post-election issue for the mass movements out there today.
And Hillary gives part of her plan away by saying that a big part of her plan will be unleashing the power, these are her words, the power of private sector to create more jobs at higher pay. And that's always been a code word for incentivizing private companies through taxes or subsidies to create more jobs. And should tell us what her green jobs program will really be about, subsidies to corporations.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's no reason to believe that Clinton, as president, would do anything different than Clinton as first advisor to Bill Clinton did in the 1990s. The drastic paradigm shift towards neoliberalism, in fact, occurred not so much with Reagan and Bush one, but with Bill Clinton, leading up to the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the unleashing of the power of the banks upon the people and allowing them privileges they had not known for close to 70 years at that time. So why would we expect her to do anything else? And I don't expect her to do anything else. Stagnant economic growth will continue. Economic and wealth inequality will continue. Poverty will continue to grow, and real actual unemployment and underemployment will remain at levels of a depression, that is anywhere between 15 and 20%. But then again, no one can rule out the real possibility of another great recession. The European economy is in recession as we speak, and China has been experiencing industrial slowdown for a couple of years now. So those chickens could come home to roost. And that on top of an already existing weak economy with high levels of unemployment and underemployment and increasing poverty.
When we think about the crusader, it's been mentioned by others here that Robin and Mabel were part of a network. They helped establish a network. And just looking at the Crusader, you see it branched and began to bring several groups of people together. And this was something that helped promote this whole movement around self-defense. There were already people in the South practicing armed self-defense. The thing that distinguishes Robert is Robert, he's an advocate. Most people were practicing it quietly. You know, people who were not only veterans, but part of lodges. You know, people who were members of the same church. It was more like informal associations and networks that black folks had in their communities to protect and defend themselves. But they were quiet. They didn't talk about it. Robert Williams was a vocal advocate. In the 1957 movement that developed in Monroe, the Crusader became the vehicle to talk about it to folks, right? And so you have here in Detroit people like, that was mentioned before, Grace and James Boggs, they're part of that network to defend and support that movement, right? And you go to New York, Queen Mother Eileen Moore, she's who, you know, is the mother of, modern day mother of our reparations movement. She's promoting the Crusader and supporting the movement. Muhammad already talked about Malcolm, and I don't know if everybody gets the significance of what he's talking about. In the temple of the Nation of Islam, they didn't do that, right? So this is something exceptional for the Nation of Islam to do at that particular time, is to support that. But I think it's based upon two things. At that particular time in our history, all of our folks looked at the South. We looked at the South as the home. You know, even when we had homecomings for church, people would look toward the South. And on the other end, if you look at Montgomery, people identify with the Montgomery movement and help bring us together. I think that was part of the thing, our national consciousness leaning South. So we were Muslim, Christian, Marxist. People began to look at that movement of Robert and Mabel and others talk about defending ourselves. But besides them, you also had people like John Henry Clark, who began to organize again around the Crusader and get money, not just to support the movement there, but what? Buy guns, ammunition. In fact, it said that John Henry Clark and John Oliver Killens, the great poet, driving to Monroe to deliver guns and ammunition to folks down there. So this is a large movement. It even goes beyond black folks because you have people in left organizations like the Workers' World Party, I learned this from Muhammad, and the Socialist Workers' Party, who raised money to support. And even after Robert was forced into exile, were part of the defense network for Monroe defendants. So this is an under-recognized part of our movement that initiated and brought different forces together around this whole concept of self-defense. And I think it's important that if you look at a group that hadn't been mentioned today that came out of this city, Uhuru, part of their inspiration and part of what pulls them together to work with Muhammad and John and young people in California, some of my mentors who published a journal called Soul Book. What pulls them all together in this network became called RAM, Revolutionary Action Movement, which was the first group to promote this concept of what we call revolutionary nationalism. It's pulled together through Robert in support of this armed self-defense movement. And so I think that's an important part of our struggle. Let me close with this. As I mentioned, I wrote the book, We Will Shoot Back. And after the recent events, particularly in Dallas, someone called me and asked me to write an article. Remember when the police officers were shot, initially they arrested this brother who was openly carrying a rifle. So I wrote a response to it, and I basically talked about how it's a challenge in America because on the one hand, they promote right to bear arms for white people. But when black people carry guns, it becomes a dilemma. And so one of the things I called for was, as I mentioned, in the 60s and the 50s, because our communities were more cohesive, then we had a more of a consciousness of watching each other's back. Self-defense was already practiced. And I argued that one of the things my wife pointed out to me one time, we were in a conversation when the Martin trial was going on. And my wife talked about how Trayvon Martin was on the phone with his friend Rachel. And he said, this creepy ass crackers is following me. And my wife always said, wouldn't it have been different if Trayvon could have called his, or told Rachel, call my daddy. And then the network was mobilized, and you know, it would have been a whole different thing with Zimmerman in that night, right? Yeah. So my thing was, I made an appeal to our community that we need to have a consciousness of watching each other's back. But here's the funny thing, the person that wrote me, asked me to write the blog, they were scared to publish it, because they said, Akinyele, it sounds like you're telling black people to arm themselves. I said, black people are already armed. The problem is the lack of consciousness and cohesiveness in our community. We saw Robert talk about the influx of drugs into our community. That's brought all types of guns. There wasn't even around during the time we're talking about, right? There's all type of armament in our community. But what's lacking is the type of network. So when we look at the Williams family, as I said, a family that was a unit of struggle, we need to reunite our communities, reunite our families to build that community consciousness and cohesiveness. In spite of all this damn gentrification I see here in Detroit and others of our cities, you know, that's used to disperse us, right? So we got to be intentional about building community, building family, building networks, building our neighborhoods, building cooperative collectives to resist this gentrification that's going down. And part of studying what happened in Monroe and Robert Williams and Mabel Williams and Williams family will be a way we can help counter it for the new generation. Thank you all. Free land.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.